SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Hour three on this Monday, and we're in Tucson at University of Arizona, not on campus. One of these trips to Tucson, I should get over and see the actual university. I have yet to actually see the university. So that I should probably do.
That's probably on the agenda
right?
to get done one of these years, Steve.
I agree. And
taking a basketball game.
There you go. Midnight loot. Baffert comes regularly. He'll zip over if it's convenient. And there's so many prominent, not just trainers. I mean, from whether it's on the animal side or whether it's on the administrative side, business side, countless University of Arizona grads. And the program, this program, I mean, the symposium itself, you know, the kids do such a great job. It's their highlight every year. When was your first one? When did you first start coming to this?
It was back in 1990, I believe, was my first, when I was executive director of the Pennsylvania Racing Commission at that time. So started to take in a lot of the racing symposium, the ARCI meetings, all of those model rules things. And a big topic back then was uniform medication. And I'm glad to see that in usual racing industry fashion, 28 years later, we're still talking about uniform medication across the country.
Well, but we're certainly closer than you were in 1990 anyway. It's funny because I didn't know you in that era, obviously, but I didn't realize that you came from that. From that side, from the business end, and from the regulator side.
Well, that was my first official job in the business. 1988, I got appointed executive director of the Racing Commission. But my real entree was about 6 or 7 years earlier, when I was living in Washington D.C. Fell in with a whole group of guys at Poor Robert's bar up on Connecticut Avenue in D.C. And among the luminaries that hung out there, in addition to my buddies, Vinny Emerson, Billy, and a whole bunch of the staff and hardcores, were Andy Beyer and Paul Corman. They were regulars at the bar, and that's where I got my handicapping tutelage, was at their feet at Poor Robert's.
Wow.
So that was my education back then.
What were you doing, though, that you got swept up into the regulator side? What was your proximity to the industry?
I was a handicapper.
How funny.
I was in politics. I was working on Capitol Hill and lobbying groups back in the early 80s. Went to Pennsylvania, took a job on the staff of the governor, Bob Casey. I was doing economic development work for him for a year after D.C., and a position came open to run the State Horse Racing Commission. I interviewed, and the commissioners hired me to, the governor appointed me then, to run the Racing Commission. So that was, and what really helped was the fact that for 6 years before that, I set my own speed figures. I did all of those kind of things Andy taught you how to do. And it was my education, and I breezed through the commission interviews and said, this guy knows something.
Yeah, for a change. There's been a learning curve a lot of times for state appointees and such, but wow. And then from there, bring me up to when I met you, 15 years ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, I ran the Racing Commission from 88 through 95, and that was a big period of change. I mean, three months after the governor appointed me to be director of the Racing Commission, the state was debating OTB legislation. Well, they passed it. The governor vetoed it. So, and this was the end of 88. And I, along with others, I went back to the governor and said, the industry really needs this. Commissioners went to him. We had discussions with his chief of staff and others. The racing industry had their lobbyists going to the legislature. And it turned out that brokered a semi-deal where the governor did not put up a big fight. The legislature overrode his veto. OTB came into the to Pennsylvania at the end of 88. I wrote all the regulations. We implemented it. Started South Philly, Center City, all the OTBs then across the state. Kept the industry afloat long enough to get to gaming. The slot machines and the gaming. They came in later. And, you know, so that was my official jobs in the beginning. And then in 96, I got hired by Breeders' Cup as a consultant to take over their domestic and international wagering operations. Did that for 20 years. Took on a vice presidency at the Daily Racing Forum.
That's right.
Tournament operations for them for 4 or 5 years. And said, okay, 2017, end of 2017. I said, I'm a little tired. I'm going to take some time off. Took 6 months off and got pulled back in with sport tech and sports betting once PASPA was overturned.
Well, and it is that kind of a landscape where you just hit really several of the signposts along the way that cropped up, and whether it was the innovation and the opportunity that the OTBs provided, and then the layers of new opportunity, the slot landscape, then wider casino, full-fledged casino gaming, and then the whole seven-year odyssey of Dennis Drazen and the Monmouth Park team that absolutely have created this, wholesale earthquake of seismic proportion, and it's going to open up, just countless doors. And I'm not talking about the racing side of things, or the opportunity for racing. It's creating new industry, like instantaneously.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be a landscape that no one's ever expected. The way this thing's going to play out, I don't know any of us can actually predict exactly how it's going to happen. But it's going to be a tsunami that's going to hit the racing industry. And they're going to have to be prepared for it. It's a double-edged sword. It can be a positive. It can be a negative. I mean, we've been through this in racing for many technologies, many other types of innovations, whether it's OTB, whether it's slot, whether it's alternative gaming. And we're in a situation now where we're confronting something that each state is going to pass their own type of legislation. No state yet has passed anything that has any provisions for horsemen's percentage of the purse or anything like that, and the margins are so tight in sports betting to start with. It's a very different animal than anything racing's looked at before.
The initial response and the initial avenues that have opened. Monmouth, obviously, it was the first, and Delaware Park, were the first glaring places. Where that we were going to get some hints as to direction. There's going to be quite a few conversations here the next couple of days, including the Turf Publicists annual workshop, which is specifically about legalized sports betting opportunities and how the industry's marketing arms can somehow create upside for racing. Kenny, from your vantage point, because the early returns are not encouraging, the early returns, which I think had to be somewhat anticipated, that there was going to be this influx and interest in the sports gaming and that it would take away from parimutuel handle. But to me, as a tossing it to you, my only expectation has been that it'll provide for people that have never had a chance to sports bet, but who thought that they would be a great if they had the opportunity, that once they get a taste of the difficulty factor and how hard it is, that racing should look like a fairly good proposition. If somebody wants to take wagering seriously, that if racing can position itself and try to show people that this is, you know, you have a fighting chance, things are stacked against bettors at every level, gaming, sports, or a casino, or racing, but you do have a fighting chance in parimutuel wagering, at least.
Well, the beauty of parimutuel wagering has always, and the appeal of it, has really always been you're betting against the crowd. You're not betting against somebody setting the line that knows a whole lot more about that sport than you do. You're betting against everybody else. And the odds can work in your favor if you're good. I mean, we all know guys that can make a living at this, but we all know that that's probably 10% of all the players. There's another 25 or 30% that probably break even, and there's 50 or 60% that lose on an annual basis. It's a tough game, but what it does do is, you know, 6-1. We talked a little bit about it last night. Let's look at 6-1. Sweet spot in horse racing. You love to play horses at 6-1. Bad favorite, track bias, whatever. You don't like the favorite. 6-1, 5-1 is a sweet spot. And you look at that in the sports betting contest. In order to get 6-1, generally, you've got to hit a three-team parlay against the spread in order to get 6-1. Well, your chances of hitting a three-team parlay, I think, are a whole lot worse than trying to pick that 6-1 shot, if you're selective, and going through and picking your spots. So I think there are advantages that you get in horse racing that won't present themselves in sports betting. Now, you have a huge education curve that racing still has not found a way to overcome in getting the general public. Now, what hopefully will happen is that as more and more people are attracted to the sports betting proposition, they will become educated about odds. Because the American public, unfortunately, doesn't have that same background that others around the world, particularly in the UK and Ireland and Australia, where you've had fixed odds betting for decades. So everybody grows up, and they grew up on horse racing with fixed odds betting. So they understand what 9-5 or 7-4 or 6-1 means in terms of payouts. Most American bettors and most American fans don't understand that. Now they're going to go start to bet sports betting. They're going to lay 11-10 against the line, or -110 on the money line. And they're going to go through and they're going to get educated about just how much they can win, how much they can lose, and what the various multiples are of those denominations as they make their bets. That will educate them to the point where hopefully they start to look at that and say, why am I laying 11-10 against the Redskins tonight, or on the Eagles, or whatever they're going to do tonight, and say, hold it. That's the same thing as betting a horse to show at 3-1. He's going to pay $4. I'm going to, you know, it's even money, basically. So I think that racing will have that opportunity, because you're going to have a whole generation of folks between 20 and 40 right now that are not into horse racing, but they're into sports. They're going to get educated about sports betting. Now, by the time that generation of 20 gets a little educated about this, by the time they're 30, will racing be prepared to turn them into horse racing fans? And that's an unanswered question. And it's one the industry has never answered very well in its past.
In your experience, and we certainly should fold in, your new position with Sportech is what it is, what Sportech's interests are in this side of it, and working with racetracks, and feel free to explain that. But are we as an industry, and these are all questions we're going to hear a lot of in the next 2 days here, but what should the industry do to market toward that potential consumer, customer acquisition, as it were, and because there's an expense. I mean, one thing that we as an industry don't seem to be doing much of right now is spending against that potential, going out and and figuring out where they are, the potential players, and you know, the people that could be long-term horse players and that would take the game seriously. I mean, I suppose that there's some potential to know where they're gathering by virtue of a new sports wagering landscape, and a concentration of them might be, you know, might be much more approachable from that standpoint.
Well, I think that certainly from what we've seen already in New Jersey, you know, the landscape there has changed. Folks are coming out of the woodwork to bet sports. It's phenomenal how much that's changed just in the last 3 months. And certainly Dennis and Drazen and the crew there get kudos for everything they did to get PASPA repealed and now trying to implement it there in New Jersey to the benefit of racing. You know, what we've seen there already, last month's handle was $260 million. The Nevada numbers in November were over $520 million. So you're going to see, you know, huge fan influx, whether it's into the facility or more likely through the internet and digital, is where people will gravitate. Already New Jersey's 52%, 48% to digital versus live bets. And that's only going to continue to grow. So you're going to have opportunities for racing, you know, to get people to the track to bet sports. But at the same time, you know, they're going to still gravitate. Just same way we're seeing 30% now of all the handle in the parimutuel is through digital means. So you've got all of those outlets that are doing it. So to market to these folks is going to be a very difficult thing. You're going to have to hit them at the point of sale at your facility. You're going to have to find a way to reach them digitally through an ADW, through other means of communication through the internet. There's going to be a lot of ways in which you can go out and take these education comes back to how do you get these folks to learn horse racing, because they're walking into your facility to bet the Eagles Redskins tonight, but they don't know anything about any of the racing going on. So how do you get them to turn over into that? And that's going to be a tough job. You know, odds explanation is very deep. How to handicap, how to read the form, all of those kind of things. I think we're going to have to find some ways that data is transmitted to them.
I was just going to say, this gets immediately to data, and that's something that's taking shape, of course, on the sports betting front, mm-hmm. in rapid fashion, and it's yet another area where the industry has been, frankly, remiss, and they've inhibited the open source mm-hmm. work. We had Robin Howlett after he was quashed with his project, the handicapper. Mm-hmm. You know, we charge for data. Not that the sports gambling people aren't going to charge for data, right, because they will. And I'm not talking tout purchase, but you know, for those that are going to be serious about, you know, getting next gen stats and that kind mm-hmm. of thing, so that they can make an educated wager. You know, we should be, I mean, for God's sake, Ken, we should be way ahead of the curve on this, and yet we're not.
Without a doubt. And, you know, you have to go back to some of the industry institutions and whether or not they're able to turn this around and whether the racetracks are really invested in what's going to happen here. Are they interested? You know, we've all seen what's happened with the horse racing machines and instant racing, slot palaces, et cetera, and racing has taken a back seat in a number of jurisdictions as a result of that. You know, and that can't blame the track operator. They're going where the profits are. We're going to see much the same thing in sports betting, I'm afraid. And so I think from that standpoint, you're going to need a commitment from the industry to address the issues that are going to be confronting them with regard to data, to fan education, that get to these sports bettors and be able to give them what they need to think that they can make an intelligent decision.
Right.
Just something that they, not just have fun and make a $2 wager, but to actually come back and understand what a trifecta reverse key is or something like that, or singling a, various other things that you can do. So there's ways that you can make money in horse racing that you can't in sports betting, and we are going to have to work on finding a way to get that translated to the public in an easier manner than what we're currently doing.
What portion of the industry, or what group within the industry, from your from your long history, is capable of doing this? And I mean, is there enough of a commitment, or are they just they just either asleep at the wheel, or just reactive at every at every step? And because being reactive is not going to get it done in this with this opportunity.
No, it's not. And I'm not sure that the institution currently exists that can bridge this gap. So whether that means some other people are going to have to come in and find a way to get this done, or there's going to have to be an application of technology that is currently not in use that provides that type of data and information on a manner that is easily translated to the general public, I'm not sure we currently have that institution in place. So anyway, but on where we're at here right now with with me jumping into sport tech, and certainly they're one of the leading totalizator providers around the world. We've got operations in 37 countries, over 400 customers. We've got operations in 36 U.S. states. So we're providing tote services to over 90 customers just here in the U.S. Our goal is to work with those customers and to provide a sports betting platform for them in a digital and on-track manner that delivers state-of-the-art, best-of-industry performance in the sports betting field. And we've partnered with a group called Sport Radar, which is a worldwide leading data provider in the sports betting field. They are the gold standard. They provide all of the back-end data for every single line that you see almost around the world.
I just read about them a little bit, maybe in the last 3-4 months.
Yeah, they're taking the industry by storm. They've been around
for years,
right.
Since the 70s, maybe, or is that
No, not that long.
But
no.
Are they opening their first?
No, they're simply the back end.
Okay.
They're the back end.
I read one piece about this.
They're being used by all of the major casinos,
yeah.
The providers, and sports wagering operators around the world. But all of that algorithms that go into developing that line, as particularly for in-play, because you realize how quickly you have to set a line and have a number spit out for in-play. It's almost instantaneous how quickly they're able to get that done. And the algorithms, they have hundreds of people working in their data center and so forth. So they're going to provide all of the back-end operation for the sport tech sports betting solution. We're going to be presenting some of that here at the symposium in terms of what we're looking at in terms of our kiosk and our internet digital platform to come through to deliver to the racetracks, and we're excited about where we think we can take this in providing a solution to the racetracks that is cost efficient but at the same time delivers them state-of-the-art operational expertise in the sports betting field.
This portion of it, the risk management, the risk assignment and all of that, this is the package that the potential track clients would be acquiring.
Exactly. And realize that unlike parimutuel wagering, where you have a takeout of 17% for whips and 22% or whatever for the exotics, where it blends out to 20%, sports betting works off a 6, 7, 8% hold. So it's very much smaller than racing. But that risk management, it was funny because, you know, you now have seven states that are operating sports. Mississippi actually lost money last month on sports betting on the NFL. They were $600,000 to the red for sports betting. So, you know, you do have that risk management where you're taking the bet. So the house can lose money in sports. Now, it's not going to happen over the long term, obviously. But there are short-term weeks where you could lose, a facility could lose $1 million, which is completely foreign to anything horse racing has ever seen before, is the house losing money. So that whole risk management becomes a very critical part of how you implement sports betting within your racetrack. And you know, one of the things that we do have through the sport tech model is we can actually offer the track a guaranteed model where we will guarantee them a set percentage based on handle each month, and we'll take the risk. Us and our partners will take the risk. So for a facility, let's just take New York OTB, for example. We're a quasi-public private operation where losing $1 million a week of taxpayer money may not be a viable option for them. So we have a guaranteed model that we're working on that we're going to implement and be able to offer to our clients as an alternative to that risk management where they could potentially lose money. So that's a very innovative thing that we're working on and will be implemented. And we're you know, looking at that and other manners in which we can bring some expertise to the racetracks for a sports betting solution that delivers them, you know, state-of-the-art industry standards that get them and their customers exactly what they need to make this successful for everybody involved.
Monitoring the landscape, what jurisdictions, what states from what you can tell are, because everybody's going to do this. I mean, it's a shifting sands, it seems. I mean, there's because legislative bodies in the respective states are going to have to, you know, get involved, and in some cases, plenty of them are, some of them are further along, obviously, than others.
Right.
What do you foresee as the landscape?
We have seven right now that have passed it, and we're looking, I think, conservatively, somewhere between 8 and 12 passing legislation in 2019. I think you're going to see New York come on board. I think Illinois is a possibility. Kentucky is already talking about it. So I think California is going to be a ways off. They have to go to a constitutional referendum, I think, out there. Florida is going to be a ways off because they have issues with what gaming laws were just passed through referendum this last election.
Right.
But I think that there's probably 8 to 12 states that will look at it very confidently this coming year. Connecticut is a big one for us. From our standpoint, Connecticut SportTech has the exclusive license for all of the OTBs in Connecticut.
The teletheaters.
Correct. We have 16 facilities in Connecticut. Then you have the Mohican Sun facility in Foxwoods.
Right.
You know, so we fully expect and working hard to make sure that the legislation that's introduced in January makes sure that we're part of that and we control then the sports betting through the OTBs in Connecticut. We think that's going to be a big win to get us up and going on a business-to-consumer. And that business-to-consumer end will give us so much more information compared to simply selling it into the racetracks, because then we'll have the actual consumer experience of they're walking into our facility, our teletheater, teaching them about sports betting, but also then trying to cross over into horse racing.
Well, and from that standpoint, that's fascinating because, of course, Connecticut's got no... doesn't even have Highland anymore. Mm-hmm. So there's our dogs. I mean, right? Plainfield and so forth. So even in a market like Connecticut, where there is no horse racing, live horse racing, the potential to utilize the player pool there that have an existing OTB base and obviously on and online as well, that offers that crossover pull that could have a desired result in terms of getting sports bettors that have never thought about making a wager on our horse race.
Yeah, and we're very anxious to start that process and to see just what we'll be able to do once we're able to implement the sports betting. What can we do? What can we put together special bet types that cross over? Can we put together promotions? Can we put together, you know, special events that educate people that certainly around big racing days, but we want to do it on a daily basis, try to get what will be the sports bettors into horse racing. So we're going to have an actual laboratory, I think, where we can work to try to build that business-to-consumer model on how you get sports bettors into horse racing.
Have you guys done any research to get a feel for how much handle loss, ideally in the short term, the rush or the interest in sports betting, how much damage it'll do initially? It could be permanent. I mean, you just don't know until there's some maturation.
That's a good question, Steve, because you know what we've seen so far in New Jersey has been handle has been pretty steady. We haven't seen a fall off, or I haven't heard of a fall off in talking to the representatives at Monmouth or other places. We'll see now what Pennsylvania's coming on board soon, what happens there with their racing handle. Delaware has been pretty steady. So we haven't seen an erosion yet, but we haven't seen a jump yet either. So while it's holding steady, new customers are coming in. Another 260 million was bet in Jersey last month, but that is not bet on horse racing. So, whether or not we're going to see that jump, I have my doubts. I think that, you're going to have a attrition factor. Whether that's going to be 10%, 20%, 30%, I hope it's nothing in the high numbers. But I think you will see some attrition initially once you have a rollout, particularly in the digital platform, across more states. I think racing will find it hard to compete until you can find a way to get back and turn these customers and educate them and turn them a little bit back into horse racing. But I think that initially it's going to be very difficult for racing to compete because it's the hot new item. It's the girl in the pretty dress. It's something that's new.
Yeah, it's been pent up. There's been a pent up demand for years. I mean, for those that have never had a chance to go to Vegas to make a future wager or to bet, day to day. I mean, there's plenty of people who have planned for years. They're whatever it is. They go out there during the NCAAs, for instance. Right. And, when we go for NHC, we'll make future wager bets on, baseball win-loss and World Series, whatever it might be. There is a pent-up demand. And you certainly, it would be a natural that there's going to be a certain percentage of players. And this all gets back to why it's imperative for the industry to be absolutely dutifully attentive to their existing players and their needs. And I mean, certainly, look, there's going to be things that are frustrating to players no matter what happens, but it doesn't mean that we can't be servicing them to the best of our ability. And in a lot of ways, it feels like they're taken for granted. And certainly they feel like they're taken for granted, and they're going to be courted by these new entities. I mean, there's going to be a lot of frankly, money spent in pursuit of those potential customers. And it seems like, we don't have a prepared answer or any kind of a response, and that's one of racing's great shortcomings, is that we never seem to have a rapid response team. I mean, going back to Eight Bells, it was the most glaring example.
Yeah, I think you're right that we've been short-sighted for many years, and that, part of that is the decentralization of racing. That is where racing developed, was individual racetracks, individual owners. There's, yes, you do now have the Stronach Group and Churchill Downs with multiple properties, but there still is not a great deal of cohesion amongst the 100 racetracks around the country. And there's certainly, while the NTRA makes the attempt, they don't have central authority. They don't have the ability to dictate to racetracks what to do. So you lack that league office that has been talked about for 25 years.
125 years. It goes back to 1900. I mean, it's not a new discussion. It's been going on forever.
Right. So we lack that, and so I don't know that it's going to be a comprehensive. I think it's going to be piece by piece. Us in Connecticut with Sport Tech will come up with our ways that we think, and hopefully some of those are successful and they can be adopted out. Same way that, you know, Philly Park or Penn National or Monmouth Park are all going to be trying different angles to try to turn the sports better into horse race fans. And some will work and some will fail. But if we're not trying, then we're not doing enough. So we have to make the effort, and I think that's really going to come, for the most part, on an individual-by-individual racetrack basis.
Ken Kirchner is with us, and you know, Ken, over the years, has visited when the BCBC was created at his direction and initiative, and all the contest landscape has your stamp on it, and always will going forward. Some thoughts. Let's slip in a couple of contest kinds of questions, and even some I promised the Kenny Kirchner. I give you full credit every time it comes up, because I'll never forget we were at Churchill Downs and I asked you that's got to be 10 years ago, and I 2007 or 8, whatever the year that we were there, and I said, how do you approach this day? We were talking general, and you said the reverse tri key, and that was it. And you've changed lives with that, Kenny.
I'd like to think so. I wish I would have changed mine a little more. It's not easy, but it is, one thing, in watching and handicapping over the years, and certainly being vice president Breeders' Cup and working with them for 20 years on the domestic international side and watching those races year after year after year, you learn certain patterns that sort of seem to develop in big events. And certainly in the Breeders' Cup case, you get a full field of 12 to 14 horses. And the odds board, of course, go from 2 to 1 to 50 to 1. But the beauty is that every horse is generally pointed to that race. So, look at Peter Miller's horses last year.
Yeah.
so you have those 20 and 30 to 1 shots that have pointed to this race. That it's their sole intention to try to hit the board or to win the Breeders' Cup. And so that pattern over the years just sort of developed in my mind that why am I trying to, pick this, this, and this, and I still do the pick threes, pick fours, pick fives, etc. But that reverse key trifecta, where you take that 20 to 30 to one shot and you single them in second and third place, or generally third place, and then put five on top over four horses over a single. That's $20. Play it a couple bucks. It might cost you $60 for a $3. But that potential payout in those tries where you get that 25 or 30 to one shot that ends up third, and if you catch the right combination above it, whether it's the favorite and then a 10 to one shot over a 25 to one shot, you've got a $1,000, $1 try, and if you've got it two or three times, you just made $2,000 or $3,000 off a $60 bet, and you're happy as can be because that's going to get you the whole weekend, basically, on those bet types.
It only takes one. I mean, that's what we say all the time, and the one that we can point to from, and a lot of people went to town on this, Kenny, I kept talking up Sadler's Joy.
Oh, yeah.
And that not only was Albertrani basically just biding his time to get to the BC turf, but that, as it turned out, that Churchill Downs was a layout that was going to benefit him, mm-hmm. as in terms of his style and the way he finished. And sure enough, at 37 to 1, with one of the most heavily bet favorites of the day, yes, with Enable, and a very logical second place finisher, you ended up with a $252 triple for a buck.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was the absolute textbook to me, and it made my day on Saturday with a couple of other things, but it has been something, as you said, the pattern that. And all you had to do was also listen to people like Chuck Grubbs, who won the BCBC this year, where Chuck was convinced that the number one, Accelerate wasn't losing, and then he took Gunavera, and he basically keyed Gunavera second and third with all under that same, and particularly with long shots that'll be coming late.
Yes.
That is, as opposed to trying to pick a horse that probably can't wire but might get past late. It's a little tougher to find a hard spun, to find a horse than it is to find the one that you know is coming late.
Yeah, that's a good point too, is picking up those pieces late in a race are those 20 and 30 to 1 shots that come along and are able to get you up in that third spot. And it's just a fun way to play the day. And whether you just play 3 by 2 by 1, and have fun with $6, you can do it and have a chance to make a score, which is what we're all looking at on those big race dates. And on a daily racing card, you need a full field to be able to do it. But if you have a strong opinion about a horse, don't be afraid to key him underneath.
And one of the things, one of the most valuable lessons on this is that, and we heard it from a lot of people because we talked about everybody's results for a good 2 weeks afterward. To me, as much time as we put in leading up to Triple Crown and to Breeders' Cup, you can't just get to Sunday morning and say, oh, okay, let's, I did okay yesterday. No, you got to really dig in and take away a real message. I mean, learn something from these and figure out what happened and how you're going to capitalize on it next time.
I keep my charts, my form from the Breeders' Cup or the Derby or whatever big race days are, and I'll keep them for weeks afterwards and put them in a file, and I'll go back and look at them, and then I'll pull them out the next year and say, this is what I hit last year. How'd I hit that? And this is what I missed last year. So I've got a file there with, this thick, and I'll just pull them out and review. And because it's a good exercise for a handicapper to say, what did I do right last year? What did I do wrong? And to bring that up and keep it fresh in your mind, because we all tend to get caught up in years worth of other handicapping minutiae that comes along, and we change opinions, we change styles, we do this, we do that. But it's always good to go back and look and see what you were successful at the year before.
Speaking of successful the year before and changing, did you follow the BCBC circumstances from last year?
And, yes.
And then the talk from your perspective, was the proper course of action taken? And do you think that they addressed the issues that cropped up in a satisfactory way?
Well, I think it was good that they undertook a review of the 2017 event. I think it was necessary based on the circumstances. I think I was on the show, might have been last year, afterwards. I wrote a piece in TDN about it.
That's right.
And the need for transparency in all tournaments. I don't think that there's any reason, with the technology and the data that we have now and the ability to deliver to the fans, to the players, full transparency. What did the winner play? Look at all of their picks, whether it's in the NHC, the BCBC, etc. You should have access to that information. So I think that was a big step forward. Last year, as we talked, I was not in favor of allowing point deductions on the second day to stand. It should have been, in my opinion. And when I ran it, it was disqualification the second day. That was my opinion. That was the way I felt it should have been, so forth. And it did lead to a problem last year, or controversy anyway.
Yeah.
So I think that, they have moved in the right direction to address that issue.
The contest landscape overall, because you've seen it evolve from day one at Penn National, from the time that it crawled up out
World
of
Series.
The World Series and from out of the primordial ooze and walked on land like a catfish, like a walking catfish. Are we taking advantage properly for the interest in contests. And what else, are we doing enough there on that front?
I think that the foundation is there. You know, certainly when we started the NHC back in 1999, it was $200,000. It's grown to $2.5 million in prize money on that. The BC, the first year we had, I want to say it was about $175,000. You know, and that's now up to $1.1 million. So the foundation is there. But at the same time, you know, DraftKings comes in a month ago, announces a handicapping championship for sports betting, $2.5 million right off the top. We're already eclipsed. I don't think that we have found the proper way yet to maximize all of the racing fans and to educate them and get them to participate in tournaments. We have guys every day at a racetrack that have no idea there's a tournament going on. And that's a shame. And it's also a failure of racing or the racetrack or the organizations to find a way to get these people educated and get them jumping into tournaments, because there's no reason the NHC isn't a $5 million tournament or the BCBC doesn't become a $2 or $3 million tournament. The potential is there. It hasn't been delivered yet. And hopefully the minds behind that find a way to energize themselves and the industry to get a push, because I really believe tournaments are a way to connect. And we tried to do that when we started the BCBC in 2009. Build on the poker boom, $10,000 tournament, great. Live money, great. Get players in, it's worked. We went to the internet, online qualifying. There's now 400 players, over $1 million. But you have to keep growing. Stagnation is mean you're losing ground to the rest of the world. So I think racing and the organizations need to look at this and find a new direction for some of these tournaments, because I think they're stuck in neutral right now.
Interesting. Wow. And your, you know, your view as I mean, as valuable as anybody I could ask. So and really, this seems to fit right in with the conversation we started, which is the sports betting portion, and you know, being cognizant and having an answer and a proactive approach to respond here, because there's threat obviously is an easy description, but it's a bigger animal. There's a lot, and we'll now that I know you're doing this, I didn't know until yesterday when I saw you, and I said, "What are you up to? Who are you here with?" And I found out what you were doing. So we will now utilize you in your capacity with Sport Tech, and I'm sure a lot of people hearing that Kenny Kirchner is spearheading the sales and marketing efforts at Sport Tech with their sports betting risk management operation. Kenny, thrilled to see you, thrilled to have you on for this, and continued success. And whenever you need to, you know, just let me know. I'll reach out and get you on, and we'll have more of these discussions.
I'll look forward to it, Steve, and thank you on behalf of all the racing fans for the hard work you do every single day to not just inform us, but entertain us. And to educate us, because it's important that the fans have a voice like yours to speak for them and to talk about issues that are more than just superficial, to delve into tough questions. And I appreciate the fact that you bring that to the racing audience.
I appreciate you saying that, and it's a pleasure. I love doing it. And it's hard. It's not easy sometimes. This is an industry that'll test your fortitude and your patience. We are back here tomorrow for two full days, Tuesday and Wednesday, the University of Arizona Global Symposium on Racing. Looking forward to it. I want to thank Rudy Brissett and Butchie Reed and Johnny and Kenny Kirchner. Good luck today. If you're playing, we'll talk to you from Tucson tomorrow.
It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up with ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void where prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
There's more good news about Pennsylvania's breeding program. Last year, the number of state-bred live foals rose by nearly 30%. Many other states saw a drop of between 10 and 20%. This says that Pennsylvania truly has North America's fastest-growing and most lucrative breeding program. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.